as a behavioral scientist, I'm into paternalism. I'm into regulation.
Today, we're talking to Lindsay Juarez, who's one of your prototypical started in academia, transitioned to industry social scientists. So she studied social psychology and is now working in industry. She's a director at Irrational Labs, and we have a really fascinating conversation with her.
Yes, this was a fantastic episode. Really fun. We talk about an interesting experiment and intervention that Lindsay's been a part of with TikTok. And generally also exploring what behavioral science can do to make social media better. On the topic of existential questions, really go and explore a lot of things as well. So we talk about, does behavioral science even have an impact at all? If it does it have a positive impact, and to what extent? And experiments, are they useful? Are they adding value? Should we do them? In what way? So a lot of these big questions are being answered in this really fun episode. So yeah, I think let's get it started.
Heavens to Murgatroyd.
Oh.
Well, Lindsay, welcome so much to the podcast. It's such a pleasure to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I am so excited to be on.
Today, we have some especially exciting topics. We're going a little bit out there with some hard, big existential questions. So I thought, who better to answer these questions, better to tackle them than you? It seems like also the right time of year, right? You know, we're kind of wrapping up and reflecting about what's gone on this year. And we thought, you know, why not sort of think back about how we're doing as a field, and, you know, not just this year, but in general, where is behavioral science heading? You know, how important is what we're doing? What are we doing? Are we making a difference? Those kinds of light questions that we wanted to tackle.
I was going to say, before we start, I'm a little bit curious, because Aline, you very, very briefly mentioned that you somewhat know each other from before. Like, how long have you known each other? How do you know each other?
Ah, great question. How far back? So most recently, I was at the Center for Advanced Hindsight, and obviously Aline is there. But then Aline and I actually went to the same college, like way back when. And I'm 1 year ahead of you. Is that right?
I think so. It was 2009. And I think you were eight.
Oh, eight. Yeah.
Right.
So that makes sense. So forever.
Forever.
It's really how long we've known.
I can't even remember before that time. So
exactly.
It's fair. So spill the beans. What did Aline do in college?
Oh no. I should have seen this coming. I didn't even anticipate this.
Well, I mean, it goes both ways. So this is mutually assured destruction.
It's true.
I don't know any like deep secrets that Aline would not want me to share. I mean, Reed is a wonderful place, and I can speculate as to what we all got up to. But I think it was all respectable. Very, very psychology focused. We were working hard on our thesis.
Studious every day.
Yeah.
All we did was study.
Love the library.
That's actually not untrue.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's what I feel like we're trying to be coy, but like really we're big nerds.
Well, and it's Portland, Oregon. So it's so rainy outside.
Yeah.
And you can't get up to that much. Drinking a lot of tea.
A lot of tea. Nothing else. No other substances whatsoever.
Exactly.
Well, I'm going to pretend to believe that story of only tea drinking and whatever. but yeah, that's fun. It's really fun that you guys know each other from that long back. That's cool.
So with that, why don't we go ahead and Sam, start us off with the question that we ask everyone.
Yes. So I'm curious, Lindsay, what is one thing perhaps unexpected that you've learned about human behavior through this past 2 years or so? And I know you're passionate about, for example, communicating health risk in a good way. It's certainly been, you know, some good and bad there. But I'll leave it to you. If there's anything in particular that you've kind of thought about or learned
from the pandemic.
Okay. from the pandemic? What are my life lessons here? That's a big question. So I should say I have spent the pandemic in Canada, which as someone observing the US and with people I love and care about in the US, it's been really interesting to think about local norms and how much that transfers or doesn't with the pandemic and with guidance and rules. And I think it's been a real exercise in perspective taking and figuring out how to say, like, so in Montreal, we were under curfew for a really long time. So for like a good 6 months, you couldn't be outside after 8 o'clock. And then I had family members who were, you know, they'd be at dinner in the US. And mm-hmm. I think it was just so hard for us to talk across that divide and really understand each other's perspective and experience. So that in the moment was really interesting to me. And now as the vaccines roll out and things are open again, it's also really interesting to think about how we process that and how quickly we are just like, I'm never thinking about that again. I'm just going to smash it down deep. And I think that's a really interesting human experience and something to think about as we process all of this and think about, like, as it continues to go on, how do we navigate people's understanding of risk and communicating and cross-border and all of that. So I don't know if I have a lesson there, but maybe more of an open question.
I'm curious, as you were seeing your family members and other people who didn't have a curfew and who are going out, how do you feel like you perceived that? Were you feeling, you know, even though it was something that you weren't doing by choice, did you feel superiority over, you know, their sort of quote unquote decisions? Or like, did you attribute it to, I guess, personal decision making or the environment? Or how did you sort of frame that in your mind?
I guess that I'm sure there is an element of a sort of dissonance and justification, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I'm following these rules, I'm staying inside, and it must be for the greater good. It must be because I care more. But I think it's very easy to, in this case, attribute it to the situation and just say, like, there are such different rules and such different contexts that how could you possibly not adhere to this, right? How difficult is it to go against the stream of everyone around you and all of this guidance from top down, from bottom up, to then be like the one person in your community who's masking or who's not eating indoors or meeting up at Thanksgiving? It's so contextual, right? Like, this is our bread and butter. The context and the situation matters, but it has been really salient.
And what do you think about curfew as a behavioral intervention? Do you have any thoughts on that?
It did work. I mean, I didn't go out. I should say I also had a baby at the start of the pandemic. He was born like a month before everything shut down. So actually, it has also been an interesting experience to have had this major life shift as the entire world shifted at the same time. And in some ways, it's been sort of comforting, especially at the very beginning when we were up every 2 hours and we couldn't do anything, to sort of take comfort in the fact that, like, everyone is staying inside. No one is doing anything fun.
I feel the same way. Even when you mentioned an 8 o'clock curfew, I'm like, I can't remember the last time I was out later than 8 o'clock.
I know. On the day the curfew lifted, you heard the shout go up like across the city, and we were in bed already.
There you go.
Exactly.
I love it. Awesome. So I want to jump right into the impact of behavioral science, like how much of what we're doing matters. So have you thought about this? You know, I'm sure you have.
No, never.
You know, behavioral science in many ways is taking off in the world, right? But with that, of course, comes a lot of hype. So there are lots of people saying that they're doing behavioral science when, you know, maybe they've read a couple books and are doing some light application and so on. And then, of course, you have people, you know, working in the Center for Advanced Hindsight or Rational Labs, people who are really doing the science, applying it rigorously. And I'm curious, what do you think this distribution is? And you know, even among those who are rigorously applying behavioral science, how much of an impact do you feel like we're making? I know that's a lot.
I know. Yeah. Right into the existential questions. So my bias should be clear. I obviously think behavioral science has something to offer. I think Samuel and Aline, you probably agree.
Sometimes. I have to walk myself back from the ledge other times when I do sort of reach this existential crisis and I'm like, does it matter? Are we actually doing anything real? So Yeah, I've been there.
Yeah, I go through waves. It sounds like you do too. I had a real crisis, I think, during grad school, which was back when open science was just starting. So I went to grad school at University of Virginia, where Brian Nosek and the Center for Open Science really started. And so it was dark for a little bit there. But I think I've made my peace with it. So maybe it's both, which is a sort of cop-out answer. But you, like you're saying, there are places where I think someone like slaps a social norm on top of a sales pitch. And like, this is the airlines and they're like, a million people bought flight insurance today. Don't you two want to protect your flight? And you're like, there's no way a million people bought flight insurance.
Yeah.
And so I think that, right, if that's being categorized as behavioral science and nudging, then I'm not super excited or optimistic that that's paying off in the way that I might hope it was. But I do think that generally it's an exciting time. And I think there is an increased openness and awareness to behavioral science and a willingness to say, let's think beyond just people's attitudes and preferences. And can we think more critically about structure and the designs that we put in place? And I think that's where you really start making progress. I think popular perception of choice architecture, behavioral design is social norms, a default, and that's probably like the most obvious loss aversion. And then I think those are easy terms to put on complicated phenomena that have interesting edge cases and boundaries. And so, you know, easier said than done to be a behavioral scientist. But I what I like about it is this increased openness to the mentality and the perspective on experimentation and collecting data and really seeing if the changes you make matter. And I think that's where there's a particularly exciting spot for behavioral science.
So in our current world, of course, there's a place for behavioral scientists to sit and work our magic, but imagine that you could design the universe. This might end up, you know, a little bit differently, where it's not just the airlines that are, you know, slapping on a social norm message or something, but like, how would you design the world if you could, you know, pick any way for behavioral science to be a part of it?
I would really love more behavioral science in the context of community building. And maybe that's like, I don't think it's city planning and like architecture, but maybe thinking about how we build the structures of like our built environment to be more conducive to social connections and interaction and taking more walks. I've been following a few people on Twitter who are like adamantly pro walking cities and basically like, how do we get rid of cars? How do we get people to disrupt this mindset that European cities, which are often like built around a city square and are really conducive to community in a different way, is like, oh, that's old timey architecture versus it's like, no, these are just cities built pre-cars and they prioritize a different mode of transportation and communication. So maybe that would be my goal.
Yeah.
Nice.
Love it.
I don't know. Do either of you have architecture degrees? How are you feeling about this?
Well, we've covered this in an episode.
My dad is.
Yeah. Aline's dad is architect. I was going to ask you actually. So I don't know if you know, but there's this book, Walden 2 by B.F. Skinner, where he kind of imagines the perfect world based on his idea of the world. Mm-hmm. And he kind of, you follow this protagonist who is clearly himself, who travels to this kind of community, and then he's like blown away by how amazing this community is. And so given that you mentioned community, if you would have your version of a community where you can like stumble upon it and it's different somehow or it's cool some way, like Is there something that would distinguish a community that you've been part of, maybe influencing or designing?
Okay, you're not going to let me get away with keeping it pretty abstract.
What is your Walden 3?
Well then, I think opportunities for impromptu conversations are overlooked, right? Like this is all of Nick Epley's research and his sort of line of researchers that we're very afraid to talk to strangers. We're afraid to have these conversations. We think it'll be awkward. They'll judge us. It'll get too deep or it'll be uncomfortable. And then of course, when it happens, it's delightful. And so I think figuring out ways to build those in is really nice. So maybe you like designate a conversation bench or like put on a pin or a light. I'm not sure exactly how it looks, but that's actually something that living in a predominantly French-speaking community is hitting hard for me because you have very few opportunities to just sort of like chime into a conversation impromptu.
Gotta work on your French, I guess.
I know. Gotta use my behavioral science to work on my French.
Yeah. And you might need a more aggressive intervention for the Swedish people coming to this community because they seem to be extremely hesitant to talk to anyone.
Do we put out more coffee, but maybe like the price of coffee is you have to talk to someone?
Oof. That's actually a great intervention. Do you know the Swedish highest consumption of per capita in coffee? Yeah.
I have a friend who's Swedish and he does love coffee.
Okay. I like that.
Okay. Are you starting this coffee shop?
Sure. I actually have a dream of sometime starting a coffee shop, but that's maybe for another podcast. So segueing to something a little bit different, you have been a part of this really interesting intervention working together with TikTok. And I guess starting off, could you maybe share what the intervention was and what you were trying to design for?
Yes. So TikTok, for anyone who doesn't know, is a social media platform and it's user-created videos and you like scroll through videos and just watch them. It's a very compelling algorithm. But what they approached us to do was they were worried about how to deal with unverified content on the platform. So, right, all the social media platforms are worried about misinformation and the spread of misinformation. And increasingly, people get their news from social media. I think it's like 1 in 5 is the stat. And if you are part of that 20% that's getting all your news from social media, you're much more likely to run into misinfo. And so they said, how do we address misinformation on TikTok, given that TikTok is sort of an unusual case in that it's not a news platform. You're not sharing articles in the way that you are on Facebook or Twitter, where they're doing a lot of tagging and fact-checking. And so we worked with TikTok to design a banner, a flag that goes on top of videos that are unverified. So I should say, in TikTok's defense, they take down anything that's like verifiably false. But in sort of a developing situation, or in cases where someone is filming a video and they're like, I wonder if, then that's sort of this nebulous area where they have to follow up. And so in those cases, they put a banner on it. And we worked with them to design a banner that emphasized that the content in the video might be inaccurate, that it might be unverified. And this is building on the work of Gordon Pennycook and David Rand, who have done some really spectacular stuff in misinformation space. And with a nod to Gordon and David, a lot of their work finds that most people are not maliciously sharing misinformation. It's just that the incentives are really misaligned, right? Because misinfo is often more emotional, more visceral. It's just edgier. And so you'll get more likes and more engagement on your post. And that's fun, right? Like I'm on social media because I want to connect with others. I want them to see my stuff and think that I'm smart. And so basically, how do you get people who say that they value accuracy, but in the moment are in this hot state where they want people to like their post, they're just sharing because this is something that's going to increase engagement? Can you get them to pause? And that's what the banner is about, getting people to pause for a moment. And then that decreases views by about 5%. It decreases likes on those videos by about 7%. And then where we really get a high impact is on shares. and there was sort of a second layer to the intervention. If you clicked share on a video with a flag, then another pop-up happened and it said, you know, again, remind you, this is unverified content. Are you sure you want to share? And cancel your share was sort of pre-selected for the user, but they could opt to continue and force through. But we find that that additional prompt, this sort of, again, extra friction, slow people down, that decreased the shares. 24% of people just canceled all outright, which is really, really nice for thinking about how do we keep things, how do we stop the spread, right?
I'm interested in this, the language of the unverified, this flag, and what you think that means to people. Because seeing this out of context or just hearing about it, I might think, well, most videos are not verified. And is it, what is the flag really telling me? Is it a something that I should be cautious of or wary of? Or is it just like, oh, this video hasn't gone through the process of getting verified yet? And in that case, that wouldn't raise any suspicion at all. Do you know what people, you know, how people understood that flag?
Yeah, that is a great question, especially because unverified in the context of like Twitter and Facebook, where you have like a blue check and you're a verified user,
is something else
very different.
Yeah.
So that was something we thought about a lot and sort of playing with copy. We did a lot of pre-testing to see does inaccurate, because accuracy is the sort of adjective of choice that the MIT team did. And ultimately, we didn't see anything strong enough in our pretest that suggested people were distinguishing between inaccurate and unverified in a way that made them more or less likely to think that they would engage with the video. So we went with unverified for like semantic and legal reasons. Uh-huh. But I don't think TikTok has verified users currently, or at least they didn't at the time. So it might be something that they'd have to evolve if that becomes the case in the future. Because yeah, it means certain things in certain contexts. But I think maybe another thing, podcasts are an audio platform, so people can't see the intervention. But we also had a yellow warning sign on the banner. So I think even if you're scrolling through quickly and you're not really reading our text in the particular adjective that we chose, mm-hmm. there is this sort of visual cue, like something is different here. Look out.
Yeah. And we can link to your write-up or whatever you want to share with everyone. We'll make that available.
Yeah. One more question here that I'm curious to talk about is that I was one of the early people that is in Sweden with the whole time well spent movement, which is now humane technology and mm-hmm. so on. So thinking about how we can have time on our devices better spent, not that devices are bad or good, but like anything, it's a tool. And so how can we kind of make the best use of this time we spend with them? And, you know, social media is generally the big, oftentimes like, I wouldn't say villain per se, but maybe villain or the kind of pointing to like, oh, you're stealing our time, or you're misusing our time, or you're spreading misinformation in some negative way. And generally, it's often like this huge misaligned incentives that makes it really hard to truly solve, quote unquote, the problem with some social media. I'm not talking about only TikTok here, or clearly TikTok, but something like Facebook or all of these platforms often rely on things like ad revenues and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. That this makes it so good for them when people share things. And even though that there's a little bit of misinformation, or there's some maybe bad results from the activities of users, it's kind of in the best interest still for the platform. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've thought a lot about this. And so I'm just curious a little bit in general, how you think about social media platforms as a whole, and if there's something we can do kind of going forward to maybe get a little bit closer to them being something that can make the world closer together, connected, better, you know, all these good things that can come from being connected. Versus the bad. Yeah.
When you redesign the world with behavioral science in mind, where do you put social media?
Yeah. It's tough to not like immediately go to extremes with social media, right? Because there's so many headlines where you're like, Instagram is ruining the lives of teen girls. And I do think there are like obviously a lot of bad things that are happening out there, but it can be such a nice tool when used well or when used not so much. And I don't know exactly what the answer is. I guess I, as a behavioral scientist, am into paternalism. I'm into regulation. So I'm pro regulation in this space. I think both like thinking about privacy and use and the way they have to share data with outsiders as maybe like an ombudsman type situation is probably a step in the right direction. And then I really like the different guardrails that are in place for thinking about timing and like omitting follower counts and things that make it a little bit harder to compare yourself, which I think is where part of the at least like mental health things come from. And so maybe some of that is a matter of like defaulting people into those guardrails, because as it currently stands, the platforms create them, right? You can turn on screen time or screen limits and time limits and things, but you have to opt into that. And so maybe it would be better if sort of everything was automatically like, you only have 15 minutes on Instagram. You only have 15 minutes here and there. Because otherwise, yeah, it's very hard to turn it off. I don't know about you. Speaking for myself, it can be tough.
Yeah. I set all of those limits, but it's so easy to get past them. You know, you just say, no, thank you. I would like to keep using the Instagram.
Exactly. And
there you go. Yeah, it's like not even a barrier anymore. But let's say that you are TikTok and you're tasked with redesigning TikTok for humanity, right? So like, you know, you're more interested in the well-being of your users than you are in the bottom line of TikTok. How would you redesign it entirely?
Where's my money coming from? Can I get rid of ads?
Just imagine that you don't have to worry about money.
Ah, what a nice day.
Yeah, nice world.
Exactly. I do think the not having the funding come from how can I keep as many people in this platform as long as possible and clicking the most outrageous stuff, mm-hmm, is probably a huge step in the right direction. I don't know in the real world, not just our hypothetical, where that funding comes from. And
taxes.
There we go. We're coming right back to regulation.
Yeah, right.
That's true. I'm curious how the like Twitter subscription model is going to play out, mm-hmm, for them and what that looks like. But yeah, I think you got to get rid of ads. And then I think something that's really simple, but isn't currently an option as far as I know, is the ability to sort of reset your algorithm and, mm-hmm, say like, I've gone too far. Mm-hmm. I've clicked too many, mm-hmm, things. I need a clean slate. And if it's possible to do that in some circumstances would be really nice.
I like that. Yeah. You've like reached the depths of cat videos and you just like can't go any deeper. You just need to like get out.
Needs to stop.
Hard refresh. Yeah, I like
exactly
that.
Yeah, I think that's great. And I would say that it's incredible with TikTok we talked about it with Eric Johnson in a previous podcast where, you know, they've done a really amazing job of just collecting and using kind of information about their users in a very effective way. Well, I don't really see that from pretty much any platform where they kind of like tease, you know, these clips that they know is popular for the most part, for like everyone likes these clips. The first, I guessing like the first 50 clips you see, it's probably been safely assured to be like super likely to be popular. And then they then find like these really quick ways to just, you know, source people into topics they find interesting. And then they show the cutest cats and the cutest dogs, whatever interest you have. And I think it's really useful from a standpoint of trying to like create a loop where you quickly understand what your user likes and serve that to them. I don't know if anyone does it better than TikTok, honestly. Like, I feel like they are really good at that, for good or bad. Like, I'm really impressed in a way.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about experiments. So we're sort of classically trained in RCTs and, you know, in really, I don't know, this sort of gold standard of test everything through a randomized controlled trial. And like, this is how we learn. This is how we infer causation. This is how we like understand what's really working in the world. Of course, in the real world outside of academia, it's not always possible to do this. You know, we both know there are organizations far and wide that are just not always that interested in running experiment after experiment, or even if they are interested in testing one thing, we still have to pick and choose, you know, what's worth testing, what's not worth testing. And so I'm curious how you navigate this territory of when to experiment, when not to experiment, and really what you think the value of testing is in this real world sort of applied behavioral science environment.
I should just like put it out there. I love an experiment for all the reasons that you have laid out. And I guess I would continue to be really bullish on experiments because I think it's currently too easy for an organization to not do any sort of testing. And I think there's this perception that experiments have to be really arduous or they have to take a really long time and they're going to be complicated. And sometimes that's really not the case. I will grant you that sometimes it's a major undertaking. Many an experiment has been in the process for like months or years before it actually happens. But I think they are just so valuable for getting at what's really causing this and the ability to pin it down and say, this is the only thing that was different between these two groups. And so we know that this is what has driven this change is just so meaningful and so compelling and then so valuable that it's hard to think of replacing it. So like in the TikTok context, there are actually three conditions to that study. There's not just a banner or no banner. There is a banner in the third condition that appears after a delay because in some initial testing and interviews with users, many people were like, a banner would be totally new in the TikTok context. And I would be really intrigued if there was this extra layer of information on a video. I might be more likely to watch something rather than less likely and deterred by the warning sign. And so that was a third condition in the study we ran. Ultimately, we didn't find a difference there, but it was this real open question of like, oh, that is a great point. What if something mm-hmm. that really changes the user experience is going to get more people seeing this information than we thought?
A great point, but you wouldn't have known without doing the experiment that actually these intuitions were incorrect, right?
Yeah, exactly. Intuitions, so complicated, so bad, potentially. So I, in grad school, worked with Tim Wilson for a while, who is all about like telling more than we can know, and people create these reasons for their actions, whether or not that's actually what's driving their behavior. And so I think I'm perhaps especially skeptical that just by asking people to predict their behavior or just using our intuition that we're ever going to get as good of evidence as we could otherwise. But there are lots of ways to like do a quasi-experiment for sure.
It's true. I once had a small breakdown at I won't say which organization this was with, but there was a speaker that came to my organization and was talking all about user research. And, you know, we could talk about that in a different context because of course there's some value, but the conclusion that was being drawn from this was that you should, you know, simply listen to the intuitions of your users. And this is a good way to understand, you know, rather than doing science. And my breakdown included sending Tim Wilson's article that you mentioned to the entire organization and with a small rant about how this is incorrect. Like the only way we can really know is through experiments. So that is not my rosiest moment, but yeah, it's real.
So related to this, like part of what you're mentioning as well, Lindsay, is that idea of, you know, let's paint a picture that we have only this like one experiment to make. We have very limited resources to actually run the experiment. We can maybe say we'll have three conditions, but we only have one shot to test this thing. How do you think about getting to that stage of selecting three conditions? Like what is usually the way you would approach that? Because we're teasing that just having user interviews might not complete the picture. And so what is in general your steps to that place?
Yeah, that's true. We don't go like straight to the experiment. Like here's an experiment to test our intuitions. I assume this is the case for all of you. There is a vast body of researchers and academics and practitioners who are also doing behavioral science and doing really great work. And so whenever possible, it's nice to start with a literature review and make Yay. Sure we're building, sort of standing on the shoulders of the giants who came before us. So that is obviously a big piece. We do a ton of pre-testing. I know we poo-pooed user research a minute ago and interviews, but that does come into play. I'll throw a bone. So a lot of prep work ahead of time.
When you say pre-testing, I'm sure some people might have not really know what that actually entails. What do you mean by pre-testing?
So it varies exactly what it looks like by the situation, but when possible, try to do an experimental pre-test with the conditions that we're considering or the language. And so presenting, I think in our TikTok pretest, for example, we used an online panel of TikTok users and we had, I think, 10 different intervention designs that we had mocked up and presented. And it was still sort of a hypothetical scenario. So we're asking people, imagine you saw this video. If you saw this video, like, what would you think about it? What's the likelihood you think that you would like it, share it, view it, whatever, which is not as good as actual behavioral data. But, you know, it, like you're saying, it's resource intensive to run an experiment, to run a field study, especially in product when it's going to be live. And so you do want to do as much in advance to make sure that you're stacking the deck in your favor, right?
Yeah. Awesome. I think it's time for our recurring segment called Underrated versus Overrated. And it's pretty simple. Lindsay, we're going to share with you some things from the world and ask you whether you think they are underrated or overrated. And these are going to be somewhat random, but hopefully relevant for you at the same time. And it's a kind of a more of a quick fire round than our normal set of questions. Are you ready?
I am ready.
Okay. TikTok dances, overrated or underrated?
Underrated. They seem really hard. I'm not a good dancer. So it's nice. They're bringing people together.
You've never done one as part of the user research to TikTok?
No, I watched a lot of them, but I cannot explain to you how bad I am at dancing. In high school, I got most improved twice. I was my best friend was a dancer and she made me go on the dance team. I was so bad.
How about academia?
As someone who opted out of academia, I got to go overrated. There's this whole world of applied behavioral science. That's where you could be.
Agreed.
Yeah, you're speaking to the right crowd right now.
Exactly. That answer is going to land well.
Yeah. Montreal's underground city.
Overrated. I want to like it. And probably partly this is tied up with COVID because it's not as fun to be inside with masks on all the time. But you hear a lot of talk, like 30 miles. I don't think it's actually that big. Overrated.
How about Bar?
Bar. Oh, the exercise okay. I love it. Underrated. Not enough people are doing it.
Why? Why is it underrated?
Well, it's small isometric movements, so lengthen and tone. I love it because at least when I was doing it, you didn't have to be graceful. You didn't have to be good at dancing, but it's a nice low impact exercise. I also not good at dancing, not good at cardio. And so I need more indoor exercises.
Nice. Very quick side note on this. Because I noticed that you had this as a side hustle on your website. What do you think about having like a physical, like call it a gig or something as a side hustle? Because it seems like a very good commitment device to be active.
I am sure that doing it as an instructor was a big part of me being as committed to physical fitness then. So I moved to Montreal and I didn't speak enough French to teach yoga or bar here. And very rapidly was not doing as much physical activity as before. So yeah, definitely a commitment device. This is my solution to physical exercise interventions is just everybody becomes a teacher.
I love it. Yeah. That works in all kinds of domains, really.
It's true, right? Like it actually is science-backed, right? You teach someone, you learn it better.
Yep.
I love it. What about behavioral science consulting?
We're getting back to existential. I think it's currently, like, as a practice or as a recipient. Either way, I'm going to say it's underrated. I think it's a great way to have a lot of different contexts for interesting human problems. So I love doing it as a consultant. And I also think that there are still lots of situations out there that would benefit from a behavioral science perspective. So underrated out in practice too.
In like 10 years in the future, do you see the ratio of, let's say, in-house behavioral scientists versus consultant behavioral scientists being the same, more in one direction? What is your prediction?
I hope more in-house, which would be unfortunate for me as a consultant, but I think it works best when you really get to fold in and spend a lot of time immersed. And so that, right, suggests in-house is a really powerful way to do it.
All right. Last but not least, Renfair.
100% perfect, perfectly rated.
That's what I would have said.
Exactly.
Can I be the awkward person and ask, like, who is Renfair?
Oh, yeah, we should be clear. It's not like a medieval Renaissance fair. But at the end of, in May, every end of the school year at Reed, where Aline and I went to college, there is Ren Fair, which is like a 3-day bacchanalia, might be a fair word.
Oh, it's a what? I thought it was a who. Okay.
Oh, yeah. It's a state of mind.
It's a massive celebration. It's sort of like, you know, whatever college someone went to, your end of year party, but 1,000,000,000,000,000,000 times better, basically. Okay, wow. That's what it is.
Yeah. It could never be overrated.
I agree. It's just true.
Well, well done. I'd say you did a great job with overrated, underrated. Our final, our final question, which has kind of been a theme for this season as well, is to ask you, what's one thing you've changed your mind about?
Something that I don't know if I've changed my mind completely, but I just hadn't ever given it a ton of thought. And now I'm thinking about it. I'm obsessed with it. Is I recently read The Art of Gathering by Priya Parker. And I am just evangelical about this book. I like cannot say enough good things about it. But I could never do it justice to sum it up. But basically, she is a group facilitator, and she is very interested in thinking about how do we make more intentional gatherings, whether it is the UN meeting or your birthday party or, you know, the regular status update at work, and thinking about how do we get a lot clearer on the purpose of meetings and then design those meetings in a way that supports that, makes it easier, makes it more fun. I think she's a latent behavioral designer. Maybe she wouldn't categorize herself as such, but like, what's that key behavior or like the essence of your meeting, your gathering, and then build everything to support it. I just loved this book. And so I had not thought about meetings and gatherings in such an explicitly behavioral science way, but now I do. And watch out, everybody.
And experiments.
Exactly. We had a retreat the other week, and Kristen mostly organized it. And I think she has also read this book, but we conspired to think a lot about beginning and endings, which is a key part of this. Basically, Priya Parker is like, never let people just trickle into your party. You have to have like a gong that sets it off, or some sort of clear demarcation that now we're in this unique space with these ephemeral rules and expectations. So I think I'm going to get really into toasts. Like cheers toast.
Yeah.
As opposed to
not like crostinis. Yeah.
Exactly.
Toasts all around. Exactly. Everyone take a bite.
This is a tangent. Does any of you watch Succession, the show?
Yes.
Did you see the last episode where there's a birthday party?
Oh God, it was a very clear beginning. Special demarcation, but excruciating. Everything on the show is excruciating.
Yes. That's the first thing that came to mind to me when you said clear beginning. This was so much fun, Lindsay. So much fun.
Thank you for having me. This was fun.
Thanks for listening to the Behavioral Design Podcast from Habit Weekly and the Center for Advanced Hindsight at Duke University. Make sure to subscribe to the show. And if you like what we're doing here, don't forget to share it with a friend or colleague. Our fantastic show music is Murgatroyd by the wonderful Dave Pissarro. And big thanks to the team at Orange Wall Media for the production of this episode. Thanks again for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks with another deep dive into all things behavioral design.
Heavens to Murgatroyd. Oh,
blah.